book that first gained fame for him in this country, Screwtape Letters, is a curious bit of correspondence. All of it from a senior tempter in hell to one of his junior tempters, working on a man trying to keep him from staying a Christian. So that everything is written in reverse, you know. All of the virtues of Christianity are vices, you see, in hell, and vice versa. The virtues of hell are the vices of Christianity. And so these letters are very, very excellent, you know, again, getting at what it means to be a Christian in a negative kind of way. This senior tempter is down on all of the things that Christians stand for, and very alert to the kinds of temptations that Christians fall for. This is one of the things Lewis has done. Then he did a takeoff on Pilgrim's Progress called Pilgrim's Regress. He wrote seven novels for children called the Narnia Tales. They are superb, just superb. If any of you still have young children and you want to give them Christmas gifts or birthday gifts or just plain unbirthday surprises, you can't do better than these Narnia Tales. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe would be the first one, and then the rest follow along. They're just one great big Christian allegory, sort of, with Aslan, the lion, being the Christ figure in these stories. They're full of adventure and all kinds of excitement. They're well written, just as children's literature. But they pack a tremendous wallop. Our boys love them and read them over and over again. And Jan reads them to them when they're too tired at night. And always something to talk about. Then he did some science fiction novels that are good adult entertainment, quite apart from the insight that Lewis has into character and into the gospel itself. Perelandra, Out of the Silent Planet, and so on. Then he did straight theology. A couple of broadcast talks during the Second World War gained him fame. Case for Christianity. Mere Christianity is the collection of all three. I forget what the other two are. Beyond Personality was another one. This is about God. And then he did the commentaries on biblical books, like on the Psalms, just little reflections on the Psalms. These are some of my favorites, at least. And he writes with great power and great insight. But this book, The Great Divorce, is the one that pulls together a lot of themes in Lewis. And he himself acknowledges his own debt to many, many people. He belonged to that group of writers in England that were kind of subversive Christians, you know. R.R. Tolkien, Dorothy Sayers, J.B. Phillips, Charles Williams, just a fantastic collection of people who had a tough job to do, you know, because they had the baptized pagans of the Church of England, and indeed the most baptized people in England, to begin to try to win back again. One more copy left. Here we go. Somebody wants to buy it. Or let's pass it around anyway, at least so that it gets used. How about over here? So Lewis is a marvelously versatile person, but in this book, in The Great Divorce, he draws together many a theme that is a part of his... do we have to pay attention to that?
Is that ringing for you, but people know it's starting.
Ah, this is the second bell. Well, okay, we've started. Now, you all had a chance, I think, to read your way into this a little bit. 40 or so pages you mentioned, let's just talk a little bit about the structure of the book, what he's trying to do. when, ostensibly, when does this take place to start with? When does the action in here take place? Anybody? All right, a guy, he wakes up, all right, and he's apparently somewhere in hell, perhaps, huh? The structure of the book then is a way that Lewis finds to talk about heaven and hell and almost everything in between without saying, you know, I'm going to give you a lecture on hell at this point, or I'm going to give you a lecture on heaven. Now, I use the word ostensibly because as you get to the end, of course, you see that he has something else in mind. But let's just take a little bit of time to think out some of the things that he notices about hell. What grabbed your attention as he's describing what hell is like? Anybody?
The yeah. light wasn't substantial.
All right, has no substance to it, for one thing, all right?
Boring.
It's boring.
No color.
No, all right, no color. What time of day is it?
It's dusk, but they're not sure. Some of them say it's dawn.
All right, it's an ambiguous situation that you interpret more or less as you like. Is it dusk and getting darker, or is it dawn and about to get lighter? Nobody knows. Not substantive. What about houses? How do people live here? All right?
They just think themselves a house, but it's not really a house. They are. That was a long time ago.
That's okay.
The other thing I was thinking of is that people meant nothing. Just the I. Nobody else was really.
All right. You care only about yourself. You push other people out of line. You a couple of things here. Somebody got pushed out of a queue, out of the line, and then everybody just kind of laughed and counted themselves lucky that they could move up a space or two.
It seemed like there was only one person living in each house.
Or sometimes not even one, huh? Big, empty buildings, people. He has one other thing. Where is Napoleon?
Light years away.
Light years away from the town center.
People.
Right, and then many others are even farther away than that. If we try to put all these things together, what do you think Lewis is talking about? What does this sound like? Does it sound familiar? Is he really talking about hell at this point? The title, by the way, Great Divorce, we're all clear. It has nothing to do with marriage now. We all know that. He's talking about another kind of divorce we have to get to. But what are the places that are involved in this? Well, what's this first chapter like? What does this sound like? Anybody? If it's familiar.
It's sort of the way things are in America over here.
Could we try to translate some of these things into our own experiences? What happens if we start trying to translate this into our own experience? What is all right? Let's begin with your observation. There is no substance here. What kinds of experiences do we have that Lewis is talking about at this point?
Are things like lonely persons who decide they need a friend, so they go out to make a friendship, but the friendship is a product of their own need of something instead of a real growing something. So it has the idea of wishing you had something, so going out and trying to make it, but it doesn't really have the substance because it's just the fulfillment of your own wish
uh-huh.
rather than you responding to something strong outside yourself.
Very good. How do people get houses once again?
You think of them to be.
You imagine them, all right. what do the houses, the psychological houses we live in, who makes the kinds of houses that we live in? We think them, we imagine them. Do they have substance to them? We look out on the world, every one of us, huh? How many of us can really say, you know, that the world is what we say it is, that it has, that our view of it has reality? Every one of us looks out from the self, from this guy sitting right here. I look at you and I see you not only in relation to me, you know. But is that really the way it is? Suppose somebody is up there and sees other kinds of relationships. Which is reality? The way I look at things, the relationships I perceive, or is there some vision outside of myself that gives substance to the way I see things, or that lets me see the world the way it really is? A great European theologian, coining an incredible word, but nevertheless a very good one, speaks about human existence as Mittelpunktsdasein. It means looking at the whole of the world from myself as the center, you know, seeing everything in relation to myself, right? We think that Chatfield, Minnesota is the center of the universe if we happen to live there. And everything is measured from that point, you know. Events have importance only as they impinge upon our world, right? But is that the real world? This is the kind of thing that Lewis is asking. When we talk about living in a fallen world, maybe part of the fallenness is just simply this, that we have to see everything. History and spatial relationships, human relationships, everything has to be seen in terms of this small little vantage point, you know, in which I peer out at the world around me. What Lewis is describing here then, you know, is really a kind of way in which all of us experience the world that we live in. And he's saying that it may be that these houses that we build for ourselves and out of which we then function or do not function very well, as the case may be, may really be illusory to a large extent. Peter Berger, in a book called The Precarious Vision, has applied this, or at least in a sense analyzed, all of our social relationships in this way, that they are really, in a sense, a fiction, a necessary fiction, but still a fiction. He uses some funny and sometimes insightful examples. He says, for example, that marriage is in one sense a fiction, necessary but still fictitious. We let the words of a man who wears cassock, surplice, and stole make licit at 5:10 what was illicit at 5 o'clock. You know, now what has really changed, you know? In one sense, nothing has changed, right? I am still a man. This woman next to me is still a woman. But here somebody has said some words, and by consent we have all kind of said, now that means they can go to bed together. Law. In many ways, almost the whole legal structure is a fiction. We say Richard Nixon is the most powerful man in the world, certainly the most powerful man in this country. But does this mean he's got more muscles than anybody else? Not at all. You know, this is, in a sense, just a great big fiction that all of us agree to. But let's take this fiction thing a little bit further. Let's bring it down to the level of maybe our own personality. Have any of you read a book by Hannah Green called I Never Promised You a Rose Garden? Ah, or heard of it? This is a lovely book. I shouldn't say lovely. It's a very stimulating book. It's not all that lovely. It's just stimulating. Hannah Green tells the story, it's her own story in a way, of a girl who comes out of schizophrenia. She builds, block by block, an imaginary world populated with people who punish her and who reward her, but who in some way are finally more real to her than the world that she inhabits. And when you read this book, it's the story of her own cure in a way, but as you read it, you suddenly recognize that the world in which she was living, the imaginary world she built for herself, is not all that different, certainly different only in degree from the kind of imaginary worlds that we build for ourselves. And you were talking about this, I think, very well. Instead of, you want friendship, so instead of being a friend to someone, you see, you try to draw other people into your own imaginary world. Or even worse here now, people build houses, imaginary houses, that are farther and farther away from other people. That finally is what happened to Hannah Green. And in the last stages of her illness, in the deepest depths of her schizophrenia, you know, she was totally removed from reality. Now, Lewis's main point in all of this, I think, is to say to us that we are real as people only in the last analysis when God is God for us. And in order, and you'll see this as we go along, in order to be pulled into substantive reality for ourselves, you see, we've got to be drawn out of this, I come back to this terrible word again, this Mittelpunktsdasein, this existence in which I am the center. I cannot really be myself if that's the way I live. In fact, that's an illusion, that I am my own God. It is the worst kind of illusion. I am deceiving myself, you see. Now, a couple of other things. All right, we live in a world. There are generally two possibilities for the ambiguities of life. Are we in the dawn of a new day, or are we in dusk and it's getting darker? If you think it's dawn, what are you? You're an optimist, right? If you think it's dusk, you are a pessimist. Most people in life can be pretty well, most approaches to life can be seen in these terms, right? If you say, I'm not getting older, I'm just getting more mature, you are one of the dawn type people, you know. The golden years lie yet ahead, you know, every day and every way we're getting better and better until, funk, you have a heart attack and puts an end to that. The pessimists, on the other hand, are the ones who are convinced absolutely that we're really, you know, it's dark and getting darker. Who is right? Who can tell? Is there any objective evidence, you see, in existence itself that one or the other is really right? The optimist can say, well, in the long run, humanity is going to survive. The pessimist is going to say, yeah, but that doesn't do me any good, you know, clunk. So the argument goes on. And who really is able to tell just from the evidence around us, you know, that that the optimists or the pessimists have the better case to make? Life itself, in a sense, is ambiguous just by itself. I don't know, let's see, some of you, Harv at least, has wintered here now, huh? Is this a hostile place or is it a friendly place? Do you think of Holden as hostile or friendly?
Friendly.
I mean, just the natural environment. You've been here all year now. Is it a battle to survive, or is it always just? See, most of us only see this as you know, good place. We have no idea of the effort that's involved just to keep us alive here. What food has to be carted up the lake, and what would happen if all of the mechanical systems that keep us alive would break down? Would this place be on our side, or would it be against us, the physical environment? What would you say, Han?
Realistically, I suppose it's not that much different than any other place.
Well, what is any other place like?
Different types of contingent forces, you know, whether it's things like that we muster up ourselves as persons or the physical environment, you know, just different types of problems that we that keep you out and say, well, why do we do to keep this?
Okay. All right.
You know, human.
I'm not trying to make, I was just going to use Holden as an example, but one could say this then about anything. Is the natural world in which we live hostile or friendly? Is it supportive or is it inimical? What's the evidence? Who can tell? Doctor.
Oh, I think it's hostile.
You do?
Yeah, I think you have to be defensive.
Who's an optimist? You're right. Who's an you're an optimist. What do you say?
Well, you know, it just depends on your outlook. If you're an optimist, well, you don't worry about all the little things that may happen to you. If you're a pessimist, you can foresee all kinds of tragedies before you happen.
Might they?
So,
Might they happen? Are there any inevitable tragedies?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't know.
On the other hand, there are things like our locks and our log lucky that we're bringing in.
Yeah.
35 years ago, they were there.
Yeah.
And now we're trying to put them back there just so people have a place to sit down and,
yeah.
And you know, yeah. There are places for those that hike up and these people places to sit around their locks and they're dumb. You know, they
can
hike on their elemental level. But sometimes we do take the physical that's there and do something to it that that restores them later.
All right, yes. I think I don't want to at this point make a great case, you know, that nature is evil. That would be contrary, I think, even to what Lewis is saying here, as we're going to see later on. But I think one of the things he does point out is that the life that we experience is at the very least ambiguous. We make certain choices as to whether we're going to look at it optimistically or pessimistically. A case can be made for both, I think. And that too may be part of the fallenness of the world that we live in. Lewis also has a novel, Perelandra, in which some of the creatures in that novel do not inhabit a fallen world. And for them, even death is a part of the harmonious existence that a man has in an environment that he does not find inimical, and which in the last analysis is not inimical to him. It isn't hostile to him. But here, at least, the kind of existence that he's talking about here is at least ambiguous. And then there's a curious statement in here where he talks, where the notion of threat seems to come to the surface. Thing, it's on page 12. It's about in the middle of the second section, where they talk about safety. Can somebody let's just find that section? You mean if they had to live together, they gradually learned to quarrel less? Can you find that somewhere? Page 22 in that one. Pardon? Yeah, he says he wants to go to heaven, or at least he wants to go to the place where things are real, to bring back one real thing. If you had just one real thing, people would need it, they'd cluster together, things would improve. Life would be better, at least. So need is the great thing. And he goes on, well, I don't know about that. I dare say they could be kept a bit quieter. You'd have a chance to build up a police force, knock some kind of discipline into them. Anyway, and here he dropped his voice, it'd be better, you know. Everyone admits that. Safety in numbers. Safety from what, I began? But my companion nudged me to be silent. I changed my question. "But look here," I said. "If they can get everything just by imagining it, why would they want any real things, as you call them?" "Eh? Oh, well, they'd like houses that really kept out the rain." "Their present houses don't?" "Well, of course not. How could they?" "Well, what the devil is the use in building them, then?" The intelligent man put his head closer to mine. "Safety again," he muttered. "At least the feeling of safety. It's all right now, but later on. You understand?" "What?" I said, almost involuntarily sinking my own voice to a whisper. He articulated noiselessly, as if expecting that I understood lip-reading. I put my ear close to his mouth. "Speak up," I said. "It will be dark presently," he mouthed. "You mean the evening is really going to turn into night in the end?" He nodded. "What's that got to do with it?" I said. "Well, no one wants to be out of doors when that happens." "Why?" His reply was so furtive that I had to ask him several times to repeat it, and when he had done so, being a little annoyed, I replied, without remembering to lower my voice, "Who are they? And what are you afraid they'll do to you? And why should they come out when it's dark? And what protection could an imaginary house, etc., etc.?" Now, the point is that Lewis is here pointing to the fact that if we think of existence as threatening, we may not be imagining all that much, you know. There may really be a threat to fallen existence, you know. As a matter of fact, one could say, Erich Fromm talks about this in The Art of Loving. He talks about the experience of hostility that we have. You try to suppress it, but perhaps even suppress it out of the level of your consciousness, but how a father may subconsciously resent the presence of a child in his wife's womb. And so he compensates by being overeager. This kind of hostility is almost built in there. You have a rival now for your wife's affection. Maybe even a rival for your own position. How we both want to bring the next generation along, and yet we almost fear it a little bit. One thing after another, we could say, points to the kind of threatened character of life, to the hostility that is there. We look on one another, especially if we're strangers, and we don't quite know what to do with that strange face. You walk into a classroom and you're terrified. You don't quite know whether the people there are friends or enemies, and you're mostly sure that they're enemies and that you've got to do something to assert yourself over them. There are many, many ways in which the hostility of existence manifests itself, and we become defenders. We don't always know what we're defending against. Rarely are we ever conscious of it. Some of the people who have been, in a sense, the most perceptive are the ones who reveal to us the really hostile substructure of life. The Marxist struggle interpretation of history, the Freudian interpretation of man, you know, penetrating into the darkest recesses, the kinds of things most of us don't like to think about, and yet somebody comes along and forces us to see what's there. Yeah. Well, darkness is there. Hostility is there. A lot of other things. Well, you know, we could comment on, I think many a point in these first two chapters, but just a couple of things. There's a clergyman in these first couple of chapters. Did anyone notice him? He's standing in the line. What's he talking about? Anybody notice that? He's a bishop, even, I think. Maybe this is Lewis's way of pulling a Dante on us, populating his inferno with interesting characters. What is the bishop talking about? It's a very interesting little conversation. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe it isn't in the first part. The bishop has a little theological debating society in hell. Oh, you remember that? And he's going to read a paper. Does anybody know what his paper is going to be about?
What Christ would have said if only he'd lived to mature.
Ah, yes. What an unfortunate interruption of a promising career the crucifixion turns out to be, you know? Ah, yes. And so the quest, my boy, is the whole story, he says, you know. We never really want to arrive at truth. It's always being on the way to it that is exciting. And so how tragic it was that Jesus' own career was cut off in its prime. Why, you know, maybe he would have even gotten over a lot of the stupid things he said in the parables and the crazy things he did and the miracles and all this stuff that gives us so many problems today. So we write this little paper on what would have happened to Christ, you see, if he had really lived to his full maturity. Glorious little touch. And then the other thing, the other character in here that begins to have a little life, for me at least, is the poet. What page is that on?
46.
46 is our bishop. We
no,
ought to,
the bishop, no.
Not the bishop?
No, this is part about Christ growing as he is mature.
Yeah, that is the bishop. Right, that's the one. The other one is this poet. Do you remember the characterization of the poet in here? What had happened to him? He was a bitterly abused young man. It's interesting to read this story.
The kid on the bus?
Yes.
Oh,
everything is against him, right?
Five schools, none of which properly developed his talents.
Ah, yes. He talks about Cyril Blullo. Even before we came here, I had my doubts about a man like Cyril Blullo. I always thought he was working in a false idiom, but he at least was intelligent. One could get some criticism worth hearing from him, even if he was a failure on the creative side. But now he seems to have nothing left but his self-conceit. Why, the last time I tried to read him some of my own stuff, I didn't want to listen. Then he goes on to describe this fellow. Very beginning of chapter 2, the tousle-headed poet. I had learned a good deal about him. He appeared to be a singularly ill-used man. His parents had never appreciated him. None of the five schools at which he'd been educated seemed to have made any provision for a talent and temperament such as his. To make matters worse, he had been exactly the sort of boy in whose case the examination system works out with the maximum unfairness and absurdity. It was not until he reached the university that he began to realize that all these injustices did not come by chance, but were the inevitable results of our economic system. Capitalism did not merely enslave the workers, it vitiated taste and vulgarized intellect. Hence our educational system, and hence the lack of recognition for new genius. This discovery made him a communist, but when the war came along and he saw Russia in alliance with the capitalist governments, he had found himself once more isolated and had to become a conscientious objector. The indignities he suffered at this stage of his career had, he confessed, embittered him. He decided he could serve the cause best by going to America, but then America came to the war. It was at this point he suddenly saw Sweden as the home of a really new and radical art, but the various oppressors had given him no facilities for going to Sweden. There were money troubles. His father, who'd never progressed beyond the most atrocious mental complacency and smugness of the Victorian epoch, was giving him a ludicrously inadequate allowance. He'd been very badly treated by a girl, too. He thought her really civilized and adult, and then she had unexpectedly revealed that she was a mass of bourgeois prejudices and monogamic instincts. Jealousy, possessiveness, and a quality he particularly disliked. She'd even shown herself at the end to be mean about money, and that was the last straw. He jumped under a train. Poor boy, you know. So Lewis here gives us a kind of thumbnail sketch of badly used people who aren't really all that badly used at all. Well, there are lots of things we could comment on this. I think it's important to notice what Napoleon keeps saying to himself all the time. It's everybody's fault. That's a theme that's going to be picked up a little later. What I'd like to do today, I think, though, is get into the conversations. In the third section of the book, Lewis moves us now into the opposite of this world of illusion. See, a world in which it's everybody else's fault, a world that we create for ourselves. A world in which we are badly used. You know? This is this Mittelpunkt-Dasein again, this existence at which I'm the center and I look out, and of course then everybody uses me badly. the girl that I get pregnant and who now suddenly turns out to want to marry me. Terrible thing, you know, how could she be so vulgar? The parents who don't understand, etc., etc. Or, as we're going to see, it's going to be reversed for parents later on in the conversation. But Lewis now contrasts this with another world. They come now to the place where the bus lands. And Lewis now describes this in terms of reality, substance, see, a world of illusion, a world of reality in which the people who live by illusions find the going very, very painful. The hardness of the real world is difficult to walk on. I think again of I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. The title of this book comes from the word of the doctor that treated Hannah Green and brought her out of her schizophrenia into the real world. And he, or she, I should say, this doctor keeps saying to the girl, or reality for this girl is that it isn't all that great out there. She goes and sings in a dingy little Methodist church choir, and, well, you know, it's people, but they aren't all that great. Nobody really cares that much about her. The music is pretty bad. The organist and choir director isn't all that good. The job she gets is a kind of crummy one. And the doctor always keeps saying to you, I never promised you a rose garden, but reality is better than illusion. And that's the thing that Lewis wants to say here. That's the thing that every psychologist and psychiatrist wants to say. That's finally also what Christians want to say. Illusions may seem more comfortable to us. Why not let us keep them, you know? What a shame to have to give up our illusions. But really, the saddest thing of all is to see a person who is imprisoned in, enslaved by his illusions. And reality, however painful, is necessary for us. To live in illusion is to be less than human. It's in fact to be inhuman or subhuman. It's to be sick.
Go ahead.
It may also be that. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. All right. Okay. But the point is now, that, and I think this is what needs to be said to the church, how frequently we think that pastors and Christians generally are people who live by illusion, you know? The illusion that we need a God, you know, because we're not strong enough to deal with life on its own terms. So we invent God, we invent heaven, we invent a lot of other things. There's many a person who says, this is, if the Christian lives by his illusions, I want an illusionless life, which may really be the greatest illusion of all, that one lives an illusionless life. But Lewis is saying the reverse here. He's saying in the last analysis that only if we have God as our God can we experience reality as reality, and can we ourselves become substantive human beings, that is, people who are somebody and not just nothings. All right, much of his imagery, right? I think this is gorgeous imagery here, where he talks about what life is like. But let's go to four, section four. What page is that on? And read one of these conversations. All right. Let's skip the said the ghost stuff and just have a couple of readers, a couple of men, huh? Who are some men here that have copies? Do you have a copy?
No, you do now.
Yes, you do. You just got one. You can be the big man.
Well,
I was followed by what I have called the big man, to speak more accurately, the big ghost. You'll be the big ghost, all right? And then we need the solid spirit. This is a conversation between the two of them. So you're the big ghost. Who's got a book over here?
Right there in the front.
All right. Do you have a book? All right. You want to be the solid spirit? And it begins with the words, "Don't you know me?" he shouts to the ghost. I found it impossible not to turn and attend. The face of the solid spirit, he was one of those that wore a robe, made me want to dance. All right? Now the ghost says, start us off. And don't read the, you know, said parts, but just dialogue with one another as...
I'm still having trouble finding the spot here. We're
32.
Yeah, your phrase is, well, I'm damned. All right.
Well, I'm damned. I wouldn't have believed it. It's a fair knockout. It isn't right, Lynn, you know. What about poor Jack, eh? You look pretty pleased with yourself. But what I say is, what about poor Jack?
You only hit him soon in his face.
You murdered him.
Of course I did. He's all right now.
All right. All right for you, you mean. But what about the poor chap himself, laying cold and dead?
But he isn't. I have told you. You will meet him soon. He sent you his love.
What I'd like to understand is what you're here for. As pleased as punch, you, a bloody murderer. Well, I've been walking the streets down there and living in a place like a pigsty all these years.
That is a little hard to understand at first, but it is all over now. You will be pleased about it presently. Till then, there is no need to bother about it.
No need to bother about it? Aren't you ashamed of yourself?
No. Not as you mean. I do not look at myself. Mm-hmm. I've given up myself. I had to, you know, after the murder. That was what it did for me. And that was how everything began.
I'm going to interrupt it a moment. Do you notice all the double entendre that's in many of these statements? Are you hearing some of it? His first word was, I'll be damned, you know. And we always use phrases like this. For Lewis, they're not just figures of speech, right? The guy really is, you know? I'll be damned, so he is. Now, here's another one. Your last speech now, solid spirit. I do not look at myself. I have given up myself. See? And he means this in a couple of ways. He was the murderer. He gave himself up. I mean, he's taken into custody, he was put into jail, he was in the end probably even executed, we don't know. But there's another sense, and his play on words here is that not only did he give himself up to the police, but he just gave himself up. Watch this as the conversation continues. Who's next? All right.
I'm going to have trouble with the emphasis on personal here. Without dramatic training, how should I emphasize personal?
Just read it. Personally.
Personally, I'd have thought you and I ought to be the other way around. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
Very likely we soon shall be, if you'll stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
Look at me now.
Let me add here. When he says personally, Lewis says in a way which contradicts the ordinary meaning. Yes. In short, when you say personally, you know, my opinion is, you really aren't speaking as a person at all. You know, you are denying your personhood and the other person's personhood almost the moment you use that word. Because what you're really saying is, I'm right, you know, and you got to give in to me and... You know, I'm going to have my opinion. All sorts of ways in which we become tyrants over other people just by using the word personally in this kind of a way. That's what he means here by this. All right, go on, Sal. Oh, who's at it now? The big ghost again.
Look at me now. I've gone straight all my life. I don't say I was a religious man, and I don't say I had no faults. Far from it. But I've done my best all my life, see? I've done my best by everyone. That's the sort of chap I was. I never asked for anything that wasn't mine by rights.
Right.
If I wanted a drink, I paid for it. If I took my wages, I'd done my job, see? That's the sort I was, and I don't care who knows.
Exactly.
It would be much better not to go on about that now.
Who's going on? I'm not arguing. I'm just telling you the sort of chap I was, see? I'm asking for nothing but my rights. You may think you can put me down because you're dressed up like that, which you weren't when you worked under me, and I'm only a poor man, but I got to have my rights same as you, see?
Oh no, it's not so bad as that.
See?
I haven't got my rights, or I should not be here. You will not get yours either. You'll get something far better, never fear.
Yes, let's pause here just for a moment. In this conversation, see, with a guy insisting on his rights, what do we have? What kind of a person is this? Or with what figures would you identify this? Are there people who live life in terms of rights? In terms of biblical characters, okay, we might call them legalists. Do we know any biblical characters who live like this? Yeah, the Pharisee, exactly. In fact, he was in the Gospel a couple of weeks ago. I thank thee, God, that I am not, you know, and so on. He wants his rights. There are a great many people today who talk exactly as this fellow does, huh? They want their rights, nothing less. And of course, their rights are that they are entitled to, huh? Clean air, good food, good jobs, good this, good that. Yeah. Now, all right, now, what he says here is, oh, no, it's not as bad as all that, see. If we really are going to insist upon our rights, you know, what is the verdict upon everyone who insists upon his rights? Who has a right to existence? How many of us chose to be born, you see? Not a single one. How many of us chose to be right, to be white people in the world? How many of us have a right to be white? Or how many of us have a right to be superior, you see? How many of us have a right to be alive at all, you see? The alternative here is to receive our lives as a gift, but this guy can't talk that way. And the solid spirit, of course, says, oh, it isn't that bad. You don't, you know, to live by rights, it isn't that bad. You'll get something far better than your rights. But now notice what he says. Let's go on.
Wasn't here too, when he talks yes. about rights, he means that he wants his rights plus everybody else's. That he
exactly. Okay. That's usually what we mean. It's deceptive, like the law and order phrase. You know, everybody wants order without law, but we use the phrase law and order. It sounds better. Go on. You're the, that's what I say.
That's just what I say. I haven't got my rights. I've always done my best and never done nothing wrong. What I don't see is why I should be put below a bloody murderer like you.
Who knows whether you will be. Only be happy and come with me.
Why do you keep on arguing for it? I'm only telling you the sort of chap I am. I only want my rights. I'm not asking for anybody's bleeding charity.
Then do, at once. Ask for the bleeding charity. Everything is here for the asking and nothing can be bought.
Yes, let's stop here just for a moment. What is the illusion? What is the illusion in this guy's statement here? What do you keep on arguing for? Partly, but who's doing the arguing?
He is
doing the arguing and accusing the other fellow of doing it, exactly. What is his illusion then? You know, that he's innocent and the other guy's doing it, right? That's part of the imaginary house that Lewis is talking about in the first section. Or, now, the bleeding charity bit. Bleeding is an English profanity, right? Goes back, I guess, to the blood of Christ in the Middle Ages, when bloody and bleeding were references to the blood of Christ and were forms of profanity. So everything is, you know, a bleeding charity. And Lewis turns this into, see, notice what he's doing. He's taking profanity and making it its opposite, because we are only allowed to be fallen over against that which is whole and good. You know, we're sick against that which is well. We're fallen over against that which is sinless and holy. We can only take the name of God in vain because there is a name of God to be taken at all, you see. We can only be sacrilegious about the blood of Christ because it is the blood of Christ which is God's love for us, you know. Beautiful little device here, you see, that he does with this. I don't want to interrupt this conversation all the time. Keep going. Fire away at each other.
I'm responding now.
You're responding.
Everything's here for the asking.
Right.
That may be very well for you, I dare say. They choose to let in a bloody murderer, all because he makes a poor mouth at the last moment. That's their lookout. But I don't see myself going in the same boat with you, see. Why should I? I don't want charity. I'm a decent man.
Yeah.
If I had my rights, I'd have been here long ago, and you can tell in a sense.
You can never do it like that. Your feet will never grow hard enough to walk in our grass that way. You'd be tired out before we got to the mountains, and it isn't exactly true, you know.
What isn't true?
You weren't a decent man, and you didn't do your best. We none of us were, and we none of us did. Lord bless you, it doesn't matter. There's no need to go into it all now.
You have the face to tell me I wasn't a decent chap?
Of course. Must I go into all that? I will tell you one thing to begin with. Murdering old Jack wasn't the worst thing I did. That was the work of a moment, and I was half mad when I did it. But I murdered you in my heart deliberately for years. I used to lie awake at nights thinking what I'd do to you if I ever got the chance. That is why I've been sent to you now to ask your forgiveness and to be your servant as long as you need one and longer if it pleases you. I was the worst. But all the men who worked under you felt the same. You made it hard for us, you know. And you made it hard for your wife, too, and for your children.
You mind your own business, young man. None of your lip, see? Because I'm not taking any impudence from you about my private affairs.
There are no private affairs.
I'll tell you another thing. You can clear off, see? You're not wanting. I may be only a poor man, but I'm not making pals with the murderer, let alone taking lessons from him. Made it hard for you in your life, did I? If I had you back there, I'd show you what work is.
Come and show me now. It will be joy going to the mountains. There will be plenty of work.
You don't suppose I'd go with you?
Don't refuse. You will never get there alone. And I'm the one who was sent to you.
So that's the trick, is it? I thought there'd be some damned nonsense. It's all a click of all a bloody click. Tell them I'm not coming, see? I'd rather be damned than go along with you.
Yes, yes.
I came here to get my rights, see? Not to go sniveling along on charity tied onto your apron strings. If they're too fine to have me without you, I'll go home. That's what I'll do. I'll go home. I didn't come here to be treated like a dog. I'll go home. That's what I'll do. Damn, blast the whole pack of you.
Yes, yes, and then he goes grumbling off. Again, this is so rich. A couple of things to be pointed out. When the ghost begins to tell him the truth about himself, he does it, Lewis says, with mirth dancing in his eyes. You have to. The truth about our illusions is really, in the last analysis, funny. And the best description I know of a guy who's saved is somebody who can laugh at himself, who doesn't take himself so utterly seriously. Most of us find hostility in the situations in which we live precisely because we take ourselves so seriously. We always, who is the guy who was given by the gods, I don't know, one wish, I guess, and so he finally wished that the laugh would always be on his side, because you see, we don't want anybody ever to laugh at us, and we can't really finally laugh at ourselves. What a great gift of God it is to be able to laugh at the pretense and the illusion and the defenses that we erect so laboriously around our lives, you know. The privacy that we guard because we don't want anybody to know what we really do to one another. And the hostilities and the hatreds that we nourish there. All the while, of course, completely justified, you see, to be able to laugh at ourselves. I think the one thing that frightens me about left-wing and right-wing radicals are the grim seriousness with which everything's got to be done, you know. The humorlessness of it all. And finally, that one cannot laugh at oneself. This country is in good shape as long as we still have good humor and politicians who are able to laugh at themselves. I finally gained a little respect for Spiro T. Hu when he started laughing with, you know, these Mickey Mouse watches and Spiro Agnew sweatshirts and all kinds of other stuff. And I thought, you know, there's got to be something redemptive about the guy if he can laugh with this. You know, maybe he has to, maybe he got orders to, I don't know. But in one way or another, I voted Republican, in case anybody wants to know. But it was hard to swallow Agnew. But you know, the redemptive thing about it is his ability to laugh at himself. So with mirth, the ghost begins to tell the truth. And the truth about this guy isn't at all what he imagined, you see. He really was much worse off, in a way, than he imagined. And in a sense, all of us are. But now, one other thing here. Don't refuse my help, the solid spirit said. You will never get there alone. God gave us people in the Christian community so that we could be pastoring, ministering to one another, because that's the way we're going to get where. Let's not use the getting somewhere in the sense of a journey right now. Let's just use it in the sense of finding one another. All of these things are conversations between people. We don't even learn the truth about ourselves without some kind of over against us, someone over against us who can help us. And it's a double-pronged process, in a way. The solid spirit becomes the servant of this guy. He loves him. He affirms him. And now he says, with mirth in his eye, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth about yourself so that I can help you. We've got to say a hard word to one another. But we, in the last analysis, the only person who can really say the hard word to us so that we are redeemed in hearing that hard word is someone who is committed to us, someone who loves us. The guy who gets the goods on us to use it against us is never going to bring us to repentance. Never, you see. This is why we are cast into the Christian community with a prior commitment to one another, so that in the midst of that commitment to one another, we are then also able to uncover the truth about one another. We need each other for this uncovering of the truth. Husbands and wives sometimes can do it to each other if God is very good to both of them, and if in the midst of their commitment to each other they can say the truth about each other to one another, you know. Or good friends. We more frequently perhaps learn from a good friend then, because he knows all about us and likes us anyway. God's Nathan, right? He comes to David. He's got to say the truth to David. But more importantly, he has to get David to join him and God in the insight into himself that is so necessary for repentance and for reality, finally. So he tells this story. And Nathan is a brave man. You know, I always think it wouldn't take but a flick of the javelin for Nathan to be a dead man for daring to do what he does to David. And then the other thing that strikes me is how we lay awake at night, planning what we do to the people we hate. I don't know if you have enemies like this, but I do. I've got quite a few, and it always really gets to me here, you know. I say to myself, my God, you know what, I'm going to be the one who's going to have to bring so-and-so and so-and-so. Someday I'll have to be their servant for all the nights that I highly thinking of what I'd do to them if I had the chance, you know. That's eerie. You were going to say something, and I cut you off before. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Just that we followed the theme of joy and mirth all the way through on all these solid spirits.
Yeah, right. To be real is to experience joy. And, yeah. You know, it's 5 o'clock. We have to quit. But we'll go on. Tomorrow, do we work on Saturdays at 4
or 2? No, we'd like to have...